Chapter 8, Probability Theory. Section 8.1, From Descriptive to Inferential Statistics. This chapter is a turning point in the book. The book so far has focused on descriptive statistics, numerical characterizations that help you understand your data. We are now transitioning to inferential statistics, which has the goal of using your data to make educated guesses about the world beyond your data set. Here's a metaphor. Imagine a pair of glasses. Descriptive statistics is understanding those glasses, their size, shape, color, refractory characteristics, and so on. Inferential statistics is looking through those glasses to see the world. The glasses, the data, are a tool that helps to accurately perceive your surroundings. Why start the transition from descriptive to inferential statistics with probability? Why not dive right into statistical analyses like the t-test or correlation or regression? The purpose of inferential statistics is to help you make decisions about an uncertain world, and probability theory is designed to quantify uncertainty. Indeed, it would not be controversial to claim that inferential statistics is basically just applied probability theory. Pure versus computer probabilities. Probability theory is a major topic in mathematics with a rich history that dates back several centuries. Mathematically oriented treatments of probability theory involve a lot of calculus, in particular, defining and computing integrals over probability distributions and deriving proofs of probability theorems from first principles. Now, without a solid foundation in rigorous mathematical analysis, statistics would be nothing more than a collection of seemingly sensible algorithms. But on the other hand, I believe that applied statistics can be learned, understood, and correctly applied without all the rigorous proofs and tedious derivations, and I do not want to make calculus a prerequisite for this book. So for these reasons, this chapter will be slightly different from a comparable chapter in a mathematics-heavy textbook. I will loosely refer to traditional math-heavy probability theory as pure, analytical, or theoretical, and computer applications-heavy probability theory as computer or empirical. With a focus on the latter, you will see summations instead of integrals and distributions instead of densities. Computer probability also has considerations and nuances that are not present in pure probability because digitization can involve numerical inaccuracies, rounding errors, and restricted domains. Now, you already saw an example of this in exercise 4.2 with the discrete integral of Gaussians, where they should have summed to 1 in theory, but they actually summed to some number that was less than 1. The good news is that all the concepts in this chapter can be directly implemented in Python or R and understood without 2 semesters of university-level calculus. Anyway, with that intro out of the way, let's begin. Section 8.2, What is probability? From the smallest scale of nature to the human scale of death and taxes to the galactic scale of the lifespan of black holes, nothing is certain. We cannot know for certain what will happen in the future. We can only assign probabilities to things happening. Mathematically, we may speak of absolute certainties, but reality is probabilistic. Probability is a numerical description of the chance that an event will occur. It ranges between 0 and 1, with 0 indicating absolute impossibility and 1 indicating absolute certainty. Probability can be multiplied by 100 and expressed as percent. This chapter introduces you to probability theory. Probability theory is a huge topic in its own right and is the centerpiece of physics, engineering, finance, gambling, sports, insurance, medicine, artificial intelligence, weather prediction, and myriad other topics, including statistics. There are also many closely connected areas of mathematics that would be included in a book dedicated to probability theory, such as set theory. By the end of this chapter, you will know enough probability theory to understand the statistical concepts in this book, and you'll have a solid foundation for learning applications of probability theory in other fields. Section 8.2.1, the problem with probability. The problem with probability is that it is not very intuitive, especially when you first encounter it. Sometimes probability is even counterintuitive. For example, the internet claims that there is a 40% chance that it will rain today in Osaka, Japan, where I am writing this chapter. What does that mean? The city does not exist in a superposition of 40% rain and 60% not rain. At least, that's not how we perceive and experience it. At midnight tonight, I can look back on the day and say with certainty that it did rain or it did not rain. It is a binary event that either happened or did not happen. So what does it mean for there to be a 40% probability of rain? Below, I will give several interpretations of this claim. One is correct, and the rest are incorrect. Before reading past this list, I would like you to decide which interpretation is right and why the rest are wrong. Number one, it will rain for 40% of the day. That is, 0.4 times 24 equals 9.6 hours. Number two, it will rain in 40% of the city, while 60% of the city will be dry. Number three, there is a 2 in 5 chance that it will rain today at some point somewhere in Osaka. Number 4. The weather forecasters are 40% confident that it will rain today. I hope you took the time to think about these statements. If not, you have another opportunity to give it some critical thought. Below are my answers. Number 1. Incorrect. Probability does not refer to the duration of something happening. It can rain for 5 minutes or 5 hours with 40% probability. Number two, incorrect for the same reason as above. Probability does not refer to the spatial extent of an event. Number three, correct. Before the day starts, there is a chance of rain. Some mathematical formula computes the chance that it will rain today based on a number of factors that mostly involve the weather over the past few days, and historical data of weather from this region on this date in previous years. Number four, incorrect. Confidence is different from probability. We could be 99% confident of a 40% chance of rain. In this case, 40% is our parameter estimate, and the confidence interval might be 39% to 41%. Chapter 13 is dedicated to confidence intervals, so if you are confused about this distinction now, I hope it will be clear later in the book. Examples of probabilities. I'm sure you are familiar with probabilities in day-to-day life. Here are a few examples to get you in the mood. Example 1, coin flip. A coin has two sides, each of which has a 1 in 2 or 50% chance of facing up when flipped. Example 2, die roll. By the way, the noun die is singular of dice. A standard die has 6 sides, each of which has a 1 in 6 or 16.666667 chance of facing up when rolled. With a 12-sided die, each side has a 1 in 12 or 8.33333% chance of facing up when rolled. Example 3, playing cards. A standard playing card deck has 52 cards. The probability of one card being chosen at random, say the Queen of Hearts, is 1 in 52, or 1.92%. The probability of a red card being chosen at random is 26 out of 52, or 50%. The probability of a queen of any suit being chosen at random is 4 in 52, or 7.69%. Are you seeing the patterns in these examples? There are two that I'd like to point out. First, the probability of an event is the number of those events, for example, the die showing the number 2, divided by the total number of possible events, 6 sides. The computation is that simple when all events are equally likely to occur, which is not always the case. For example, the probability of rain in the desert is not 50%, although rain and no rain are the two possible outcomes. Second, the sum over all probabilities is 1, or 100%. The probability of heads plus the probability of tails is 100%. The probability of rolling a 1, a 2, and so on up to a 6 is 100%, and so on. This is not a quirk of the specific examples I gave. It is part of the definition of probability. In fact, the sum of all probabilities in a set must sum to 100%. That should make sense intuitively. Something needs to happen. If the coin doesn't land on heads, it must land on tails. Even if we incorporate the unlikely event of landing on its side, that gives 3 events that together must sum to 100%. Now that's the theory. When you implement probabilities on computers, you might find that the sum of all probabilities is less than 100%. Such a result is theoretically incorrect, but it reflects incomplete digital implementation. You'll see examples of this later in the chapter. Section 8.2.2. Why do we need probabilities? I mentioned earlier in the book that you don't always need statistics. Likewise, you don't always need probabilities. In practice, we need to consider probabilities only when the uncertainty about the outcome of an event is relatively large. Does light travel faster than sound? We don't need probabilities for that. Will a potato fall to the ground if your friend's sister's pet gerbil pushes it off the table? No probabilities necessary. Will an Italian chef put pineapple on his pizza? Some events are so probable or so improbable that dealing with probabilities is a waste of time. Some more questions. Will it rain in November in Hanoi? Does a white patch in an MRI scan indicate that the patient has cancer? Will wearing a medical face mask in the supermarket prevent coronavirus infection? These questions involve some uncertainty, and we need probabilities to make informed decisions about them. Section 8.3, probability versus proportion. Probability and proportion are related but distinct concepts. They are easily confused because they are sometimes numerically identical. I'll start with an example and then provide definitions. Imagine flipping 10 coins and recording the results. The probability of each coin showing heads is 50%, so it is reasonable to expect that 5 of the coins will show heads. But the experiment showed that 6 out of 10 coins were heads, so in this example, 50% is the probability of heads, while 60% is the proportion of heads. This paragraph references figure 8.2, which demonstrates an imaginary experiment of flipping 10 coins. The probability of each coin being flipped and showing heads is 50%, while the proportion of heads in this experiment is 60%. The figure shows a 2x5 arrangement of imaginary coins, 4 of which are showing stars and 6 of which are showing heads. Back to the text. Here are definitions. Probability is the chance of an event occurring. Proportion is a fraction of a whole. Here is an example where probability and proportion have the same numerical result but are different quantities. I spend a total of 5.1 minutes each day brushing my teeth out of 17 waking hours, so 1,020 minutes. The proportion of my waking day spent brushing my teeth is 5.1 out of 1,020, which is 0.005 or 0.5%. The probability that a randomly selected minute of my waking day involves teeth brushing is also 0.5%. One tricky feature of probabilities is that the answer to a probability question often depends on how you ask the question. For example, the probability that I will brush my teeth during the day is 1. Another example, if I eat chocolate every Friday, then the probability of eating chocolate on a randomly selected day of the week is 1 out of 7, But the probability of eating chocolate on Monday is 0%, and the probability of eating chocolate on Friday is 100%. The proportion of days in the week during which I eat chocolate is 1 of 7, which is the same number as the probability of eating chocolate on a randomly selected day. Going back to the coin flip experiment, the probability of each coin showing heads is 50%, while the proportion of heads in the experiment was 60%. But now that all coins have been flipped, the probability of getting heads when picking up one of those coins at random is 60%. In conclusion, probability is related to uncertainty about the occurrence of events. Proportion is a descriptive statistic of an existing data set. There are no uncertainties involved in proportion because it simply involves counting the number of things that have already occurred. Furthermore, we can speak of probabilities of future events, but we cannot know proportions of future events until they actually happen. Although we can generate expectations about proportions of future events based on probabilities. Section 8.4, Computing Probabilities. Let's take a step back for a moment, ask a simple question. How can we know the probability of an event? In other words, where do probabilities come from? We can obtain probabilities from 3 sources. Source 1, intuition from semantic knowledge. Semantic knowledge is information about the world that you just know. You know that a standard die has 6 sides, and they are equally likely to face up when the die is rolled. You know that the probability of rain is higher in London than in Cairo, although you might not know the exact numerical probabilities. You know that smoking cigarettes increases the risk of lung cancer and other diseases, although you might not know the exact numerical probabilities. Most of the probabilities that you just know are useful in day-to-day life, but are useless in formal statistical analysis. In fact, many probabilities that people believe are wrong. Source 2, a mathematical formula. The probabilities that are crucial for inferential statistics are computed based on mathematical formulas. In the next few chapters, you will learn that the mechanics of determining statistical significance is to calculate the probability that a descriptive statistic of a sample reflects the characteristic of a population with known parameters. Now, that probability comes from a mathematical formula that was derived from mathematical principles, not from intuition or empirical data. Don't be intimidated, though. Some of the mathematical formulas are so simple that you can derive and compute them in your head. Others are more complicated, and we let the computers do the number crunching for us. Source 3, empirical measurements. The world is really complex. It would be nice to have a mathematical formula that would tell me the exact probability that I will have a heart attack this year. Now, there is an interesting philosophical debate about whether nature even can be so precisely mathematically described, but regardless, we simply cannot practically derive such a probability from pure mathematics. Instead, we must estimate the probability based on empirical measurements. For example, let's say that out of 100,000 men my age, 100 had a heart attack in the past year. That would mean that the probability of me having a heart attack this year is 0.1%. Now, that is a huge oversimplification because it ignores the myriad genetic and lifestyle factors that modulate my individual probability. But the point is that in many cases, especially when studying anything related to biology, including psychology and medicine, we must estimate probabilities by gathering empirical data. For convenience, I will refer to analytical probabilities or theoretical probabilities as those derived from mathematical formulas without data, and empirical probabilities as those derived from data because they cannot be derived purely from mathematical principles. Section 8.4.1, computing analytical probabilities. Analytical probabilities are derived from mathematical formulas. I already gave some simple examples earlier in this chapter. The probability of a flipped coin landing on heads is 50%. The probability of a die roll showing 6 is 1 out of 6, and so on. In these cases, the probability computation is quite straightforward. The probability of an event is the count of events of interest divided by the total number of events in the set. Then, optionally, multiply by 100 to convert to percent. I believe that that description is sensible on its own, but in the interest of completion, and also linking to the softmax function that I will introduce later in this chapter, I will write this out mathematically. Equation 8.1 reads, P of x sub I, so the probability of x sub I, equals the fraction with the numerator n of capital X equals x sub I, and the denominator is n of x. So P of x sub I is the probability that event xi occurs, for example, a die landing on the number 4. Capital X is the set of all possible events. In this example, it is the outcomes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. The numerator is the number of times that event xi can occur. And n of x in the denominator is the number of elements in the set, which in this case is 6. Two examples. Example 1, the probability of a die landing on even number is the count of all even numbers on the die divided by the number of sides of the die. That's 3 of 6, or 50%. Example 2, the probability of a die landing on a number less than 3 is 2 out of 6 equals 33.3%, because there are two outcomes that satisfy our criteria out of 6 possible outcomes. A more involved example. Statistics teachers love to fill jars with marbles. Let's imagine a jar containing 90 marbles, 40 blue, 30 yellow, and 20 orange. We assume that they are all mixed together so that the probability of randomly selecting a particular color depends only on the number of marbles of each color, as opposed to sampling biases, for example, if all the blue marbles are on the bottom. Here is the question. What is the probability of picking each color at random? In other words, what is the probability of reaching into this jar and picking out a blue marble or a yellow marble or an orange marble? I will show and explain the calculation below, but before reading further or listening further, I would like you to try making these calculations yourself and then check your work and your reasoning against mine. But before doing any math, you need to determine whether the data are valid for computing probabilities. Notice that this problem can be solved without collecting any empirical data. That is, we don't need to go to the store, buy a bunch of marbles in a jar, and randomly pull out marbles of the jar lots and lots of times. In other words, we can derive the analytical probabilities of these outcomes. In exercise 7, you will run an experiment to see how closely these analytical probabilities match the empirical probabilities computed from experimental data. The probabilities of randomly selecting each color is simply the number of marbles of that color divided by the total number of marbles. So here we have three equations. The first equation reads probability of blue equals 100 times 40 divided by 90 equals 44.4%. Next equation, probability of yellow equals 100 times 30 over 90, which equals 33.3%. Next equation, probability of orange equals 100 times 20 over 90, which is 22.2%. Back to the text. Notice that the denominator is the number of marbles, not the number of colors. That is, each marble is considered an event. So n of x in equation 8.1 would be 90, not three. In general, in mathematics, it's always a good idea to sanity check your results, which means working with your answers to confirm that they make sense. One sanity check we can do here is to sum the probabilities to confirm that they equal 100%. So here I have an equation. 44.4 plus 33.3 plus 22.2 equals 99.9. Uh-oh, these probabilities don't sum up to 100%. Have I made a mistake somewhere? Yes and no. The calculations are correct, but I've truncated the divisions. In fact, the probability of a blue marble is not equal to 44.4%. Instead, it is equal to 40 over 9, which is 44.444444. The fours never end. Same story for the other two probabilities. In other words, I've introduced precision errors, which made the sum close to, but not exactly 100%. This level of inaccuracy happens quite often with computer-implemented mathematics, and it's a level of tolerance you will need to accept. More complicated analytical probabilities. Some statistics books stick to simple examples that can be calculated in your head. Although I appreciate the motivation, I don't find that terribly helpful for people who want to apply probability theory in data science applications. In other words, examples like the marble jar are high school level probability theory. Let's be realistic. Your employer will never ask you to hand calculate the probability of randomly selecting a blue marble from a jar. Instead, you will need to compute the probability that a test statistic calculated from empirical data could have been due to chance given the sample size and variability. Probabilities like that are based on mathematical formulas and cannot be computed by hand. I mean, technically they can be computed by hand, but it's really, really difficult and extremely tedious. And thus, you will rely on numerical processing software like Python or R to tell you the answer. I will write more about these kinds of analytical probabilities with examples and visualizations later in the chapter and in subsequent chapters. But first, I want to discuss computing probabilities from empirical data sets. Section 8.4.2, Computing Empirical Probabilities. Actually, computing empirical probabilities relies on the same formula as analytical probabilities. This was equation 8.1. The only difference is that set X comes from data instead of knowledge about the world that is either known a priori, for example, a die has six sides, or is given to us by the problem description, for example, there are 40 blue marbles in the jar. But there are additional considerations when computing empirical probabilities about the data type and about the interpretation. Requirements on data to compute probabilities. There are two requirements to compute probabilities from empirical data. The first requirement is that the data must be numerical discrete, ordinal, or categorical. We cannot compute probabilities directly on interval or ratio data. Understand this requirement. Let's imagine that we want to know the empirical probability of a penguin weighing a certain amount. Because we lack a perfect mathematical model of penguin weight, we collect a data set of the weights of 100 penguins. Now, weight is a numerical ratio data type, so we could ask, for example, what is the probability of a randomly selected penguin weighing exactly 3.43721410851 kilograms? Well, that's just not a sensible question. In fact, at that precision, the probability is basically zero if we find a penguin that weighs 3.43721410852 kilograms. That is technically a different weight from what we specified. How do we deal with this problem? Perhaps you've guessed the solution. We group the weights into bins. So instead of asking the probability of some absurdly precise weight, we consider probabilities in some weight range. For example, what is the probability that a randomly selected penguin weighs between 3.0 and 3.1 kilograms. Now that is a question we can compute if we have empirical data. Footnote. It's the same concept in pure probability theory, but you would integrate the probability function between two bounds instead of binning the data and summing within a bin. The integral at exactly one point is zero because the width of the x-axis variable is infinitesimal. The point is that interval or ratio data need to be converted into discrete ranges, just like what you would do to create a histogram. A slightly more formal explanation is that ratio and interval data have arbitrary precision, which means that they are not countable, which means we cannot compute the numerator of equation 8.1. You need to count events to compute their probabilities. The second condition on the data to compute probabilities is that the data must have mutually exclusive labels or bins. This is because the sum of all probabilities of all events must be 100% or 1 if not scaling 2%. This condition is met for all the examples I've introduced so far: coin flips, die rolls, picking a card out of a deck, and the weight of a penguin. If you roll a 4, the die cannot simultaneously be a 2. If a penguin weighs between 3.0 and 3.1 kilograms, it cannot also weigh between 2.8 and 2.9 kilograms. As a counterexample, consider the imaginary experiment from Chapter 3 about where people get their news. Can we compute probabilities from that data table? The answer is no, because the labels are not mutually exclusive. You can get your news from the internet and from TV. The sum of all probabilities will be greater than 100%. Of course, we could change that experiment to allow for computing probabilities. Imagine that the survey asked respondents to report their one primary source of news. This would allow for probabilities because the answers would be mutually exclusive. Interpreting empirical probabilities. In some sense, interpreting empirical probabilities is easy and is the same as interpreting analytical probabilities. The probability of an event occurring is the chance that that event will occur. However, interpreting empirical probabilities entails a few points of difficulty from which analytical probabilities do not suffer. First, empirical probabilities are based on samples, and different samples can have different empirical probabilities due to sampling variability. I will discuss this concept in more detail in the next chapter, but it's basically the idea that different random samples from the same population are likely to be at least slightly different. Therefore, empirical probabilities will differ at least somewhat from sample to sample. Now, there are ways to address this difficulty, including measuring larger samples and computing confidence intervals. But the fact remains that empirical probabilities nearly always entail some uncertainty. The next challenge of interpreting empirical probabilities is that they are often numerically the same as proportion. As I discussed earlier in this chapter, probability is a measure of uncertainty about the world, whereas proportion is a count of things that have already happened. So when proportion and empirical probability are computed using the same formula on the same data, there is a risk of confusion because they actually indicate different quantities. For these reasons, analytical probabilities should be preferred when it is possible to compute them, and empirical probabilities should be used when necessary. We will return to this distinction of analytical versus empirical probabilities in Chapter 13 on confidence intervals and in Chapter 16 on permutation-based statistics. Section 8.5, probability functions, mass and density. Consider the following definitions. Probability, you already know. A probability function relates all of the elements in a set, that is, all possible outcomes under consideration, to their corresponding probabilities. To make this more precise, I will provide a mathematical definition in equation 8.5. Equation 8.5 reads f of x equals p, in parentheses, capital X equals lowercase x. I will get back to this equation in a moment. Back to the text. Probability, the chance that an event will occur. Probability function, a mathematical expression that relates each element in a set to a numerical probability value. Probability mass, a function that describes probabilities for a set of exclusive discrete events. Probability density, a function that describes probabilities for exclusive continuous events. Note the difference in equation 8.5 between capital X, so uppercase X, and lowercase x. The former is the set of all possible values in the variable, while the latter is a unique value from that set. I will read equation 8.5 again. F of x equals P of capital X equals lowercase x. I know it's confusing to use capital X and lowercase x, but math notation is sometimes confusing like this, and that's just something you need to live with. Anyway, this equation defines a function f that maps the probability of an event to the numerical value assigned to that event. It might help to conceptualize this function for each unique value, x sub I. This will also help you understand the requirements for f to be a probability function. Here we have a series of equations. The first equation, 8.6, reads f of x sub I equals p of capital X equals x sub I. Next equation follows from the previous equation, and it reads such that p of capital X equals lowercase x sub I is greater than or equal to 0. Next equation continues such that probability of capital X not equaling x sub I is 0. Next equation, such that the sum from I equals 1 to n of p of capital X equals x sub I equals 1. Back to the text. Equation 8.6, that's the first equation I read, is the item-level definition of a probability function to which the two subsequent statements apply. Equation 8.7 says that probability values are non-negative, and equation 8.8 says that the events within set X must be exclusive. In other words, the probability value at f of x sub I for any event other than x sub I is 0. Finally, equation 8.9, the last equation I read, says that the sum over all probabilities must equal 1. Together, these equations formalize what I hope is now intuitive from the chapter so far. Probability masses and probability densities are different types of probability functions. The distinction between them is clear. Mass is for discrete events, while density is for continuous events. You can think about it in terms of data types. So a probability mass is for categorical data, whereas probability density is for numerical, interval, or ratio data. Probability mass functions characterize discrete events, such as the outcome of a coin flip, a die roll, pass or fail, an exam performance, or disease outcome. In contrast, probability density functions characterize continuous events, such as height, wealth, distance, and temperature. Probability masses and densities are also visualized differently. Probability mass functions are visualized using bars, while probability density functions, often abbreviated to PDFs, are visualized using lines. Figure 8.4 shows some examples, all of fake data. Panel A shows the probability function of different types of cars. Car types are categorical and have no intrinsic sorting, so their probability function is visualized using bars. In panel A of figure 8.4, we see a bar plot containing 5 different types of cars, SUV, convertible, sports, minivan, and coupe, plotted as a function of their probability. These are fake data, so the values don't actually matter. just to see that a probability mass function is visualized as a bar plot. Panel B shows empirical IQ data from a sample of 100 people. Although IQ has a known analytical distribution, normally distributed with a mean of 100 and a standard deviation of 15, a limited sample size data set is discretized, which makes this probability function a mass, although we can think of this mass as an empirical estimate of a density. So panel B in figure 8.4 illustrates a histogram of fake IQ data. The mean is approximately 100, and the x-axis ranges from 50 to 150. Finally, panel C shows the theoretical distribution of IQ in the population, which is derived from an analytical function and therefore is a probability density. Panel C of figure 8.4 shows a Gaussian distribution that is peaked at 100 and tapers to close to zero at 50 and 150. Back to the text. Why do I call the histogram in panel B a probability function and not a proportion? This is an example of how the distinction between these two concepts can be confusing in empirical data. To be sure, that histogram does show proportions of binned IQ in sampled people, if these were real data. But if you ask the question, what is the chance that a randomly selected person in this group has an IQ between 98 and 102, then you can use the graph as a probability function. On the other hand, if you ask the question, how many people in this group have an IQ between 98 and 102, then the graph can be interpreted as showing proportions. There is a subtle but important point here. When you interpret panel B as proportion, you are only characterizing this particular data sample. You cannot make inferences about the rest of the population. But if you interpret it as a probability mass function, you can make inferences about the probability of a given IQ of people outside your sample, assuming, of course, that the sample is random and representative of the population. I will explain this distinction in more detail in the next two chapters. Back to mass functions and densities. When working with applied statistics on computers, continuous variables are usually discretized by binning. This means that in practice, probability functions, especially when empirically derived, are technically represented as masses, not as densities, even when the variable is continuous in the world of pure mathematics. It's often useful to think of probability masses as estimates of probability densities. Here's an example. In my imagination, I traveled to Antarctica to weigh the cutest penguins I could find. I bought an extremely high-resolution scale that can measure 10 to the minus 16 kilograms. Now I want to compute the empirical probability function that describes cute penguin weights. But here's the thing. The probability of measuring a penguin of exactly 34.536851308576081.2 kilograms is basically zero. In fact, the probability of measuring any penguin of any weight that precise is zero. So it's not terribly useful. Okay, so instead, I discretize the data to bins of 0.5 kilogram width. So what I've done is convert the real-world ratio data into discrete numerical data. The probability function that I will compute is technically a probability mass, but it is an empirical estimate of a density function. So we have lost some precision by binning, but the probability mass function will be easier to interpret and easier to work with. This paragraph references figure 8.5, which shows a probability mass of cute penguin weights. These are all fake data, using a discretization of 0.25 kilograms. So we see a histogram looks roughly normally distributed, centered around 4.5 kilograms. Back to the text. The pure math analog is that you cannot compute the discrete interval of a continuous function at a single point. You can only integrate over a range. So to compute a discrete integral, you would pick a reasonably small range of values over which to integrate, and that range corresponds to the boundaries of one histogram bin. The conclusion of this section is that probability densities are continuous mathematical functions. In Chapter 10, you will learn how to use PDFs to evaluate statistical significance during inferential statistical analysis. When working with empirical data, you would use probability masses, either because the data are categorical or because you have binned continuous data. In the latter case, the probability mass function is an estimate of a PDF. Section 8.6, cumulative distribution function, often abbreviated CDF. A cumulative distribution function is the cumulative sum of the probability mass or density function. For density functions, summation is replaced with integration. This means that each point in the CDF is the probability of obtaining a value less than or equal to that value. This can be expressed mathematically in equation 8.10, which reads capital F of X equals P of capital X less than or equal to little lowercase x. Note the subtle distinction between equations 8.5 and 8.10. They are nearly identical, except that the equal sign in the PDF becomes a less than or equal to sign in the CDF. This one character difference has a major impact. The PDF is the probability that a randomly selected data point will equal a specific value, while the CDF is the probability that a randomly selected data point will have a value less than or equal to that specific value. Figure 8.6 illustrates the distinction and the relation between the PDF and the CDF for a normal distribution. Figure 8.6 shows a PDF of a normal distribution. This is a typical Gaussian curve shown in a dashed line, and its corresponding CDF, which is indicated in a solid black line. Now, that solid black line corresponding to the CDF looks like a sigmoid or an S-shaped function. It starts close to zero, and at around -2, it starts to ramp up quickly, and it equals a probability value on the y-axis of 0.5 at the x-axis value of 0, corresponding to the center of the Gaussian. And then it continues to increase, tapering off until it gets to around 1, which is a value that it approaches asymptotically, starting at around x equals 2 or so. There is a vertical dotted line at x equals 1, and the PDF for the Gaussian function is shaded in gray from all the way to the left of the plot up to that dotted line, indicating that the numerical value of the CDF at x equals 1 is the total area left of the PDF at that point, which corresponds to the gray patch. Back to the text. Note that the dashed line in Figure 8.6 is not formally a PDF, it is scaled to facilitate visual comparison with the CDF. The shape is accurate, but the numerical values on the y-axis are too large. Transforming that into a true PDF simply involves scaling by the x-axis grid spacing. This would correspond to dx in analytical statistics. You'll get to explore this in exercise 1. Figure 8.7 shows some examples of PDFs and their corresponding CDFs. Notice that all CDFs have similar characteristics of starting at 0 and ending at 1 and monotonically increasing between those bounds. Indeed, a CDF can never decrease because it reflects the cumulative sum of non-negative values. This paragraph references Figure 8.7, which shows PDFs and CDFs for three example functions. So we have panels A, B, and C. Panel A shows a normal distribution. Panel B shows an F distribution. The F PDF looks a little bit like a Gaussian, except it is strictly positive and it is right skewed. And panel C shows a semicircular distribution, which kind of looks like a unit circle, but just the top, so just the positive parts of a unit circle. Back to the text. What is the purpose of a CDF? There are two situations in which you use a CDF. First is when you want to determine the probability that a sample will be less than or equal to a particular value or more than a particular value. For example, what is the probability that a randomly selected cute penguin weighs at least 5 kilograms? But the more important use of a CDF in inferential statistics is to compute a p-value. P-values are the linchpin of modern statistical evaluation and reporting. So yeah, CDFs are important. Final point for this section, because each point in the CDF is defined as the sum of the probabilities to the left, CDFs are interpretable only for data that can be meaningfully numerically sorted. A CDF of nominal data, so non-sortable categories, just doesn't make any sense. For example, when computing the cumulative sum over movie genres, what category is to the left of sci-fi? Section 8.7, expected value. In this section, I will define expected value, how to derive and interpret it, and how it relates to quantities like the average and variance. Have a look at the following formulas for the average and expected value. In the equations below, E of x indicates the expected value of variable x, and P sub I is the probability of drawing data point x sub I. Please take a moment to inspect these two equations to determine, number one, their differences, and number two, the circumstances under which they would converge. Here we have equations 8.11 and 8.12. Equation 8.11 reads x bar equals the sum from I equals 1 to n of x sub I divided by n. Equation 8.12 reads E of x, so the expected value of x, equals the sum from I equals 1 to n of x sub I times p sub I. Back to the text. I'll start with their differences. The average involves dividing by the sample size, while the expected value involves multiplying by the probability. Indeed, you can think of the expected value as a weighted average, where the weights are defined by the probability that each value occurs. This observation leads to the condition under which the two equations would be equal, when p sub I equals 1 divided by n. In other words, when all data values are equally likely to be selected. Now, when p sub I does not equal 1 over n, the average and expected value would be equal if the distribution is symmetric, such that the sum of probabilities left and right of the mean are the same. But there is a more important difference between the expected value and the average, which is not apparent in the equations, and it is this. The expected value is a theoretical calculation from a distribution, whereas the average is an empirical, descriptive statistic of a data sample. You don't need data to compute the expected value, but you do need data to compute an average. Let's work through an example. Imagine we have a weighted die that has probabilities of showing different faces according to figure 8.8. Figure 8.8 is a table showing probabilities for each side of a weighted die. The table has two columns. The first column is the side of the die. The second column is the probability of observing a face of that die. So we have sides 1 and 2 have probability of 1/4, and sides 3, 4, 5, and 6 each has a probability of 1/8. Back to the text. You can quickly confirm that the values in the second column, the probability column, satisfy the requirements for a probability mass function. All values are between 0 and 1 and sum to 1, and all events are mutually exclusive. We can compute its expected value using equation 8.12. To compute expected value of this weighted die, we take the expected value of x is equal to 1 over 4 plus 2 over 4 plus 3 over 8 plus 4 over 8 plus 5 over 8 plus 6 over 8 equals 3. The numerators of each fraction that I just read off correspond to the values of each side, and the denominators are their probabilities. The expected value is 3, which you can compare with the expected value of 3.5 for an unweighted die. We can also compute the average by rolling this die some number of times. So imagine the numbers below are the results of rolling this die 8 times. Here we have data set X equals 1, 3, 4, 4, 4, 3, 2, 5. And X bar is 3.25. By this point in the book, I'm sure you are not surprised that the sample descriptive statistic is not identical to the expected value. Section 8.7.1, Computing Expected Value. The most accurate way to compute the expected value of a distribution is to compute it analytically. That is possible for distributions that are mathematically characterized. As an example, I will derive the expected value of the uniform distribution. The analytical uniform distribution is continuous, and so we use integrals instead of sums. Footnote: if you are unfamiliar with calculus, then don't fret about the equations. Just focus on the concepts. Here we have a series of equations, which starts from equation 8.13, which reads, the expected value of x is the definite integral from a to b of x divided by b minus a times dx. Then there is a series of equations here where I evaluate the definite integral. I'm not going to read through all of those equations. The upshot, the take-home, is equation 8.18, which reads the fraction b plus a divided by 2. Back to the text. In conclusion, equation 8.18 shows that the expected value of the uniform distribution is just the average of the boundaries. That's pretty neat because we just rigorously proved a result that we intuited in Chapter 5. Estimating expected values. Many data distributions and PDFs in the real world are unknown. If you want to estimate the expected value from data, you have two options. First, you can examine the histogram of the data, make an educated guess about the distribution, and then compute the expected value of that analytical distribution. For example, many empirical distributions look Gaussian, so you can use an analytical Gaussian with the same mean and standard deviation as your empirical data. Second, you can compute the weighted average of the data, where the weights are derived from the proportions of the values occurring. Using empirical proportions, you'll remember, is an estimate of probability. Keep in mind that empirical averages will not be as accurate as the analytical expected value. Indeed, you can think of the expected value as the average of a data set with a sample size of infinity. Any sample with a finite sample size will be merely an estimate. Section 8.7.2, Expected Value and Statistical Moments. Statistical moments of distributions can be expressed as the expected value of the data raised to the power of the moment. For example, the first moment is e of x, the second moment is e of x squared, and more generally, the kth moment is e of x to the power k. These are the unstandardized moments. We can compute the expected variance of a distribution as its mean centered second moment. Here we have equation 8.19. which reads sigma squared sub x, so the variance of x, equals e of, so the expected value of, the quantity x minus e of x squared. And that can be simplified in equation 820 as e of x squared minus the quantity e of x squared. Back to the text. I will go through this equation for the uniform distribution. We have already derived the expected value, or the first moment, of the uniform distribution, so the subtracted term in equation 820 is simply equation 8.18 squared. So let's integrate the first term to find its value. Here we have equation 8.21. This reads the expected value of, or e of, x squared equals the definite integral from a to b of x squared divided by b minus a dx. Here again, I have a series of equations, which is mostly just evaluating that integral and then performing some algebraic simplifications. There's quite a bit of thick algebra that gets in here. A few steps I actually skip, but the upshot leads us to equation 8.28, which is b squared minus a squared divided by 12. Back to the text. I have omitted a few lines of algebraic simplification. It gets a bit hairy in there with all the factoring, simplifying, and canceling. But I did want to show you the origin of the mysterious factor of 12 in the denominator of the variance of the uniform distribution. It comes from combining two fractions that have 3 and 4 in the denominators. Now, I realize that this walkthrough was a bit deep in the weeds and math-heavy. If you enjoyed it, then you might consider pursuing more mathematical treatments of probability theory. If you found it tedious or incomprehensible, then don't worry, the rest of this book is much more intuition and application focused. Section 8.8, Softmax. Softmax is a mathematical transformation that converts a set of numbers into a probability mass. It is frequently used in machine learning, less so in statistics, but the softmax operation is sufficiently important that it's worth taking the time to understand. A probability mass derived via the softmax operation has a slightly non-standard interpretation because it does not directly map onto the chance of an event occurring. Instead, the softmax function transforms numerical values that encode predictions into a distribution of probabilities that a given decision will be made. So the values in X need not be counts or proportions. In fact, they can also be negative numbers. Let me show you the softmax equation, and then I'll unpack what I wrote in this paragraph. Equation 8.29 reads sigma of x sub I equals fraction. The numerator is e to the x sub I, and the denominator is the sum from j equals 1 to n of e to the x sub j. Back to the text. The softmax equation says that each data value's x sub I is quote-unquote softmaxified by taking the ratio of its natural exponent to the sum of the natural exponentials of all data values. The Greek letter sigma is often used to indicate the softmax function. Don't confuse this with the standard deviation of x, which would be denoted as sigma sub x. So we have sigma parenthesis x to indicate the softmax function, and sigma sub x to indicate the standard deviation of x. Figure 8.9 shows a numerical example. Note that the raw numbers increase linearly, while the softmax transform numbers increase exponentially. You can also confirm that the three softmax numbers sum to 1, which satisfies one of the requirements of a probability distribution. This paragraph references figure 8.9, which shows a table with two columns. The left column is raw, the right column is softmax. There are three rows of data in this table. The left column has rows 4, 5, 7, and the right column has values 0.042, 0.114, and 0.844. Back to the text. Figure 8.10 shows the softmax transformation for a larger range of numbers. The transformation appears flat for values less than 2, but in fact those numbers are non-zero but small. That is apparent when inspecting the same data using a logarithmic y-axis scaling, which is shown in panel B. This paragraph references figure 8.10, which shows an illustration of the impact of applying the softmax function on the y-axis to a data set of numerical values on the x-axis. In panel A, we see the softmaxified values in linear space, and they look kind of flat for raw data values ranging from minus 6 up to around 2 on the x-axis, and then they appear to skyrocket up to infinity as we go on the x-axis from 2 up to around 6. Panel B shows the same data, but the y-axis is logarithmically scaled. And here we see a linear relationship between the x and y axes. Back to the text. Now that I've shown the formula and a few examples, let me answer two questions you might have about the softmax function. Does sigma of x really produce a probability mass function? Yes, because it satisfies the requirements of a probability distribution. The events are mutually exclusive. Each sigma of x sub I is bound between 0 and 1, and that's because the natural exponential function is positive valued and the division by the sum caps the output at 1, and the sum of all sigma values equals 1. This final conjecture can be proven by writing the sum over all sigma values. Here we have equation 8.30, which reads the sum from I equals 1 to n of sigma of x sub I equals the sum of the fraction e to the x sub I divided by the sum from j equals 1 to n of e to the x sub j, which equals a fraction where the numerator is the sum from I equals 1 to n of e to the x sub I divided by the sum from j equals 1 to n of e to the x sub j. Essentially, equation 8.30 shows that when you write out the sum of the sigma function for all values of x, you end up with a ratio of something to itself, so a sum to itself, and that, of course, equals 1. Back to the text. What is softmax used for? Softmax is often used in machine learning classification tasks. The idea is that a classifier model will transform sample data into a numerical value for each class. For example, transforming a set of pixel intensity values into a label of cat versus dog versus elephant. Those values will be transformed into a probability mass via the softmax function, and then a label will be selected at random according to the probability values. Imagine a classifier that uses medical imaging data to predict whether a patient has no tumor, benign tumor, or a malignant tumor. Now, for a particular patient, the classifier produces the numerical output values shown in figure 8.9. That was the figure I described earlier, with two columns corresponding to raw numbers and their softmax transformation, which are then passed through a softmax function. The classifier would conclude that there is a 4% chance of no tumor, an 11% chance of a benign tumor, and an 84% chance of a malignant tumor. Section 8.9, exercises. As you now know, I am not reading the exercises here in this audiobook because I described the exercises and their solutions in my videos on my YouTube channel. End of chapter 8.